Want to drive greater success in social commerce? With Deloitte's latest creator economy research, you can. After surveying over 500 creators and 500 brands, our insights are helping CMOs and marketing teams harness the power of content creators. And not only that, but how to do it well. See for yourself by visiting cmo.deloitte.com today. Your website is the front door of your business, but the way teams build and optimize it is broken. Stuck between inflexible templates and cumbersome code-dependent solutions, there's a better, faster way. Enter Webflow, a visual-first platform that empowers you to create freely. Now you can ship web pages in weeks instead of months and save millions in development costs. These are the real results for companies like Orange Theory, one that I love, Dropbox, and IDEO. Get started today at webflow.com. Webflow, more than a website builder. What is the first brand as a young boy that you remember making an emotional impact on you?
I would say my big aha moment as a kid, the brand I remember really having was Pepsi. I mean, I'm a child of the 80s, but I'm a child of the late 70s. But my formative years were in the mid 80s when you had Pepsi at the height of the next generation, the Michael Jackson, the Cola Wars. That was my intro to advertising and marketing. And so I remember being just bowled over by some of the work that Pepsi did, you know, in the 80s. Oddly enough, I go to work for Yum, which is a PepsiCo spinoff, years later. So you know, full circle. But that was the one that truly, for me, when I look back, of sort of maybe sparked my interest in marketing before I knew I was interested in marketing.
Hi, I'm Jim Stengel, and I help major brands find their purpose and activate it, and the profits follow. For 7 years, I was the global marketing officer for Procter & Gamble, where I oversaw the marketing of hundreds of brands. You may not know it, but the CMOs, the chief marketing officers of all of your favorite brands, are trying to connect you with your favorite products and services through purpose. And on this show, I delve into how they do it. My guest today on the CMO podcast is Jeff Jenkins, the EVP of Global Marketing at Carter's Inc., the $3.5 billion buy sales market leader in baby and children's apparel. Their brands include Carter's, Oshkosh B'gosh, and a host of other brands, some exclusive to retailers. Carter's roots go back to 1865. It now sells its brands in the U.S. and Canada through 1,000 company-owned stores and through all major retailers. My guest Jeff has a most unconventional career path. He was an actor, a tennis player, he worked at NASA in marketing, Yum Brands, Whole Foods, and CKE Brands, that is Hardee's and Carl's Jr. This is Jeff's second CMO role. He has been CMO at Carter's for nearly 3 years. The most conventional part of his career is his education, a bachelor's from University of Virginia and an MBA from UCLA Anderson. This is my conversation with a guy who was actually in my class when I taught at UCLA. Here's Jeff Jenkins. Jeff, welcome to the CMO podcast. Way before you were a CMO, you were an actor. So we have to start there. What got you into acting and why did you walk away from it?
So my acting career started totally by accident. I was at the University of Virginia where I went to college. And at some point during there was a filming, or I should say photo shoot, for Abercrombie's first ever catalog. And they were pulling kids in and out of the
cafeteria. So you were a very handsome young man. That's what that's saying.
I don't know. I was, let's call this, at best, I was a background performer. I was not the hero, the main person. But it opened my eyes and got me a couple other opportunities to go do some things. And then suddenly it became a little bit of a career. And I got cast in a play that went on for 2 years. I did it 600 and something times over 2 years. It was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. I can't sing, it's not a musical, but it was an incredible time and it was going to New York. Well, I got to New York and was living in New York and I was sort of bored because you only have to work 2 hours a day. You do the show from 8 to 10 at night, you show up at 7 and I have a high internal motor. I wanted to keep doing things. And so I got a temp job at MTV. And that temp job happened to be working for the first ever creative director for MTV, who had left MTV, retired, and come back. His name was Fred Seibert. And he created the phrase, "I want my MTV." And he'd come back to do take what was then the Nashville network into what is now what became Spike TV. And he was doing a rebranding effort. And I was a lowly sort of temporary worker that then got asked to stay on and got to work on a bunch of marketing promotions. And it opened my eyes to the world of marketing. And I was like, this is what I want to be doing. This is so exciting. You know, we were doing man on the street interviews. We had sort of free creative control because MTV was, we were this big in the scheme of MTV's world. And, you know, he sort of took me under his wing and taught me a lot without really probably even knowing my name, but he was just a very kind-hearted individual. And so that opened my eyes. And I said, this sort of acting thing was a total accident, but it taught me amazing things about teamwork, about responding and listening to the audience, knowing your consumer, your audience, how they're responding, taught me a lot of great things, but I just was hooked on marketing from the time I started, was at MTV.
So what was the show?
It was called Big Love, which is no relation to the Showtime show. It was a retelling by a playwright named Charles Mee. It was a retelling of Aeschylus's The Suppliant Women, which was the first known play that's still on the books. It's about 50 cousins who are engaged to 50 sisters and sort of the shenanigans that go on. It was retold in sort of actually an MTV style way, WWE, the floors were trampolines. It was very wild. I was actually throwing circular saw blades against a wall halfway through the show. It was a big hit. But then 9/11 happened and Broadway shut down right as about we were about ready to transfer to Broadway.
What a great start to a career.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was a fun thing. And, you know, that led to a few things on TV here and there and Star Trek and a couple other fun things. But then, you know, my wife looked at me at one point as I was working in the marketing world and doing this acting thing. And she said, is this acting thing serious? She was my then girlfriend, now wife. And she was like, because I don't
Good really question don't think, by that girlfriend.
Yeah. She said, do you really think you're going to be a movie star? And I said, I really don't think so. And she said, I think it's time to pivot.
Wow. Great coach. Well, listen, I want to stay with your career path for a minute because you've also been, I think I have this right, a traveling tennis player. You worked at NASA. You earned your MBA at UCLA Anderson. You worked in quick serve restaurant. You worked in grocery retail and now baby and toddler apparel. So this career path just gets better and better. So Jeff, I want you to share with us what the red thread is in this really interesting career journey.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things that you, when you look forward, it's hard to see the dots and how they connect. But when you look back, you start to pull on that thread and see, oh, now I see how it all comes together. I've always been curious about what makes people tick. You know, I used to, when I lived in Los Angeles and when I was working at NASA, I worked for the Jet Propulsion Lab, which is the home of unmanned robotic exploration of space. So think the Mars rovers, the Hubble telescope, things of that nature. They're all based out of Pasadena, California. And I worked there for 8 years. I'm insatiably curious. I wanna know how things work. I wanna know what makes people tick. And that's sort of what's followed me. When I was a tennis player in high school, I fell in love with this band overseas. Brought the CD home to the United States and wanted to share with all my friends. It was Ace of Base, All That She Wants Is Another Baby. And it became popular here, not because I had anything to do with it, but the A&R people at one of the major records thought it was a good song. But I've always been intrigued by what makes people tick and what makes people decide on their choices. And then how I could help influence or shepherd brands into that space. So at NASA, it was all about people want to know how the universe works and what an exciting thing. And you had unbelievably smart people, like smarter than I could ever imagine even being. But those incredibly smart people didn't always have the skill set to be able to translate what they knew to the general public that were so insatiable for how the universe works. So I felt I had this opportunity to, you know, help translate some of that into, you know, what I would say is general population speak. At that point, I also found that, you know, the government life of work wasn't for me. And I went back to the UCLA Anderson. I ran into a really fabulous professor there that taught a brand marketing class that you may have heard of, Professor Jim Stengel, in my days. And, you know,
I'm very proud of the student, by the way. You know, for the audience, I taught at UCLA for 5 years after I left Procter & Gamble.
And I was fortunate to be in Jim's first class. I think it was your first,
that was a pilot.
First year. And it was a thing that turned me on into really how to move it into consumer brands. So that year I got into Taco Bell. I thought I'd be there for 2 years. But what I found was an insatiable love of retail. I love how fast the world works. I love how you can you have control. If you own the channel, you own this. And so it was really just around following those dots. And I was at Taco Bell almost a decade. I was overseas at KFC Australia. I started a new brand for Yum. It just was constant learning, always asking, give me the assignment. Someone once gave me the advice. I think it was Greg Creed at Yum that said, there's no traffic if you make your own lane. And so for there, that's been the thread of my career, is finding assignments that simply didn't exist before I took them. So whether it would be starting a new brand called US Taco Company, that, by the way, was an epic failure, but it taught me, it's probably the thing in an interview, a job interview I get asked about all the time, but it was an epic failure. Then similarly, it took me.
So why did it fail? What was your big lesson out of that?
My big lesson on why US Taco Company failed. One is, I think we tied it too closely to Taco Bell. Going upstream from Taco Bell into a fast casual world was, even though the brand had nothing to do with Taco Bell, it was anchored in the consumer's mind. And I thought we'd get separation. We did not. We also opened one location and missed on our location. And in restaurants, location is everything. We were one block off. Had we been one block over, we would have been, I think, in a real hot spot. And then secondarily, we also didn't get our liquor license. We were supposed to get a liquor license, and the city changed after we'd already booked the spot. And without liquor, the sort of concept didn't have the profitability. I still stand by it. It's probably some of the best work I've ever done. And from a branding, from a menu construction, from an experiential standpoint, I still think it's one of my favorite things I've ever worked on. But ultimately, it was a greatest learning space for me that I've ever had.
Well, I have to ask this as a professor. You know, you always wonder the people that you teach, what they remember years later, if anything. So you were part of my pilot class years ago, where it was a class really about how to bring purpose to life on your brand and business. Yep. and the growth that will follow. What do you remember from that class? What has stayed with you? A person that came in? A concept?
A concept. So the brand tree. Right. I will tell you, and I could probably find it somewhere in the hard drives buried in my house. I have a brand tree for US Taco Company. I also put a brand tree together for Whole Foods when I was working there. So, you know, really around starting with an insight. And even
and
here,
the brand tree is really a framework for your brand and what it means and how to bring it to life with everyone inside and outside the company.
Yeah, 100%. And even here at Carter's today, right? That's one of the things that we have started with our positioning. You know, we're a 160-year-old company, and we are a brand that's evolved. We have a 160-year-old brand that's called Carter's. We have a 127-year-old brand that is Oshkosh B'gosh, and a number of new brands. And for each one of these brands, we've gone through the exercise of defining our purpose in today's world, defining who our consumer is, defining what our mission and our values, all those things that I learned in that pilot class around the framework of the brand tree, we put to use in my everyday life. That's probably the thing I will say I carried with me and have built at multiple companies behind the scenes, not publicly, but behind the scenes, it still sticks with me.
I was at the Kellogg School last week teaching an exec ed class, and we really talked about brand frameworks. It's so important as a marketing leader to have some framework for behavior for your company on your brand to help everyone know their role in bringing the brand to life. It's such a powerful idea. I find that companies or brands that don't have that are not consistent over time. They're not credible. They're very fragmented. They don't have a clear idea of what they stand for in the minds of the people that they're trying to delight. So what you're bringing to life in your career, and obviously you're successful at it, I think that concept is a foundational part of it.
Oh, no doubt. And I think even in more so in today's environment. Yeah. You know, years ago, I think when people were staying at companies 40s and 50 years, that brand framework was sort of baked into the ethos of everyone who'd been there for 40 years. And they just knew, and they knew their customers. Now with people moving around a lot more, you need that framework documented and written down and breathed and reiterated day in and day out for people to really understand how important it can be for the life of the company.
What would you say is the key to success for today's CMO? If you said data, you wouldn't be the only one. At Deloitte, however, we believe data is only half of the equation. The other half, story. Because data is the language of business, but story is the language of humans. And we believe the most successful CMOs know how to harness the power of both data and story. To learn more about Deloitte's CMO program and how we can help today's CMOs succeed, visit cmo.deloitte.com. You are 3 years as CMO this summer, and I've heard you say that you are having the time of your life. You love your role. You love this category. You love this company. So what is it about this time in your life, Jeff, that has you so jazzed?
You know, when my wife and I were laying in bed one night, I was CMO at the time and the job before this in a QSR world, my second stint in QSR. And my wife sort of turned to me at one point and said, at what point are you going to put your marketing powers, your superpowers, you know, as she calls them, your marketing superpowers to good? She said, you've worked a lot of places. You don't eat a lot of fast food. Nothing. I love the category, but she was like, it's, you know, we don't serve our kids a lot of fast food. Mm-hmm. When are you going to be able to make an impact on kids' lives using this sort of, you know, gift you've been given around marketing and that you've worked hard to develop? And that was a light bulb moment for me. And, you know, when the opportunity came for Carter's and I met our CEO and our president and, you know, it sort of ticked. I said, these are unbelievable people. It is a category that is just ripe with emotion. You know, I always say there's probably only two categories out there in which you don't have to sort of manufacture emotion. I had to manufacture a lot of emotion around a burrito. I don't have to manufacture a lot of emotion around what it means to be a parent. Sports are the other category. I think there's a lot of, emotion sort of inlaid in there. But for me, I'm in a category which is ripe with emotion. I'm in a category where I think in children's apparel, no one in a lot of years has really tapped into what it means to be a parent in a modern way. I'm a parent of a 9 and an 11-year-old. And 11 years ago when I had my first child, the way of raising a parent or raising a child is way different than even 11 years ago. I wasn't scrolling through TikTok at 3 a.m. during a feeding. I was, you know, I didn't even have video monitors. I had like a little monitor, a little sound monitor. I make myself sound dated. But I'm in a fun category that's moving really fast. I'm at a market leader. We are essentially, I always call us the Coca-Cola of baby. You know, 96% of parents in America have one of our brands in their closet, whether you're a young mom who's on WIC or Snap, or whether you're Kim Kardashian putting your kids in our Oshkosh B'gosh overalls or a collaboration we do with Kif. You know, we're everywhere. And so you add up the sort of category, the emotion, and then you add in just amazing people. Right. We have a, you know, culture is everything. And culture at Carter's is unparalleled in not only in the category of apparel, but just overall. And I'm having fun. And the people that are on my team that really make all of the work possible are just unbelievable.
We have to get your wife on this podcast. She sounds like a great management coach.
Oh, my wife is no doubt the best management coach I will ever have. She is also really good at business. She's a full-time mom right now. But you're talking about a powerhouse who ran spreadsheets for Yeti and Nike and many other great brands. But she, more than that, she gets what makes me tick and what motivates me. And I would not be anywhere close to the man, the dad, the leader I am today without her by my side.
Well, be sure she listens to this, Jeff. And I would have to say my wife also is my best coach and advocate and friend and is always honest with me. And I told her I was interviewing you this afternoon. And she goes, oh my, I was just in a Carter store yesterday. And I loved it. That we have one about a mile away from our house. And we have lots of family having babies right now, including my son and daughter-in-law. So she is in your store a lot, spending a lot of money and really happy about it.
Oh, that's good to hear. And you know, I think the good news is that 2022 is, and I think it's a 30-year high for weddings. And so once people get married, the usual next step is kids. So hopefully that's a boon for our business in the years to come.
I've also heard you say that a CMO job is 90% chief and 10% marketing. I would love you to talk more about that.
Yeah, you know, I think when I was an associate brand manager or brand manager, I looked up at the CMO and said, they control all of the marketing. That must be the most fun marketing job that you can imagine, and you get to do all of the marketing. And what I found as I've gone up the ranks and as I talk to my peers who are in similar chairs to me is that, you know, 90% of what I do is about resource allocation. How do we spend the funds? How do we staff the team? How do we create an organizational structure to maximize our talent? Only 10% of my time is really doing the marketing strategy. I set the strategy in partnership with my team and my insights partners and my brand partners and my channel leads. But ultimately, they have to go and bring it to life. And they get to do, you know, they get to take a germ of an idea and bring it into an unbelievable, beautiful flower. Sometimes they bring the seeds more than that. They often bring the ideas to me and I just get to say, yes, let's go do it or let's not do it. But most of my time is spent working on things like capital allocation. You know, I sit as a executive leader, I'm sure you were, I sit on things like the risk management committee of a publicly traded corporation. There's different elements of my job that aren't necessarily marketing. I'm learning an unbelievable amount. And, you know, it's now, I always say, when I walk by someone's desk in the marketing department, I'm dangerous because I may say something and they may take it and run with it. And I've got to be careful about what I say because I now sit in a different chair than I was when I was a brand manager. But a lot of what I have to do is really around the mechanics of being part of a large organization and inspiring and leading people and not necessarily executing, you know, which social post goes out today versus tomorrow versus the channel allocation.
Jeff, how'd you make that transition as you got more senior? Because when you're young, you know, you're 90% marketing and I don't know, 10% chief, whatever. And that kind of starts to move and evolve as you get more senior. And I totally know what you're saying here. And I think that's a great outlook on the job. 90% chief, 10% marketing. How did you yourself as a leader make that transition? How intentional was it? Did you just evolve into it? Did you have a coach or mentor who helped you with that?
Yeah, I've had several great mentors that have helped me. And then a little bit of obviously trial by fire. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the hardest thing you have to learn as you grow as a leader is letting go without fail. You have to understand that you may assign someone a task and they may not do it up to your standards. But if you were to go do it and get it up to your standards, that may be a waste of time and energy for what your job and my responsibility. My responsibility is to set the strategy, not make sure that one social post on Tuesday is perfect. And my job is to inspire and teach them so they do reach the level of my expectation and hopefully exceed that. And I think that's the hardest part as a leader, is learning to let go. And so I've had several mentors across my career, inside of Yum Brands, at Whole Foods, people like yourself through business school that I've met, another professor that I remained friends with, Sanjay Sood, mm-hmm. Taught me a lot about that. And then, you know, I made a mistake. Quite frankly, I can tell you many mistakes where I did not let go and I got burned. And, you know, one of my previous CEOs, a gentleman by the name of Jason Marker, who was the president of KFC, you know, rode me pretty hard on learning to let go. And so a culmination of all those people and then those, you know, it's like a kid reach up and touch the stove and get burned, you learn not to do it again and you learn to trust and empower people and just get out of the way.
So your job now is primarily culture, resource allocation. Where exactly are you focused right now? What are the most important priorities for you as a CMO, as a leader right now at Carter's?
Yeah, I would say there's probably two or three places where I'm intensely focused. One is, you know, we are in one of the most wild three-year periods in the history of mankind. You know, we've had a global recession. We've had, you know, lots of cultural issues bubbling up. We have now, whether you think it's a recession or a stock market crash or whatever it might be, we're down 30%. And you have a lot of people worried. And you have, you know, a tough environment out there, both personally and professionally. People are exhausted. People are burnt out. People are struggling mentally at home in their personal lives. And we've been in a work from home environment. So I would say my number one job is to the team, to make sure that they're in a good space, to keep them excited, to keep them engaged, to help them continue to learn and grow. So that is number one. Second is around, one of the funny things that I think that's a thread throughout my career is that I've always been involved in businesses. While they look different, whether it's fast food or baby clothes, they look different on the outside. They're actually the same. I've been involved in a lot of life stage brands. So you move into Taco Bell when you turn 16 and you get the keys to your car and you go to Taco Bell where mom and dad normally wouldn't take you and you're out of the brand by your, you know, late 20s. We have to acquire every new would-be parent out there in America every year. And so we have to go out and acquire those. There's roughly 3.6 million beautiful babies born every year. I need to acquire as many of those parents as possible. And so, you know, for me, it's all about acquisition. How do you find all those new parents and how do you remain relevant to those new parents with a brand that is irrelevant today as it was 160 years ago? And so the sort of brand relevance, you know, we just hired a new chief CMO, alongside me, a chief mom officer in Hillary Duff. And so, you know, she's joined the brand to help give parents guidance and be relevant to the next generation of parents. So I now share my CMO title. So, you know, those are the jobs that
That's a good person to share it with.
It's a great person to share it with.
Your website is the front door of your business, but the way teams build and optimize it is simply broken. Stuck between inflexible templates and cumbersome code-dependent solutions, there's a better, faster way. Enter Webflow, a visual-first platform that empowers you to create freely. Experience a CMS where you can build dynamic content without code. Native localization that lets you translate your site in one click to reach global audiences. And third-party apps and integrations so you can build faster. Now you can ship web pages in weeks instead of months and save millions in development costs. These are the real results for companies like Orange Theory, Dropbox, and IDEO. Get started today at webflow.com. Webflow, more than a website builder. So I want to get your perspective on three issues where I think you have a unique point of view based on your background and experience. And the first one is this tension between so-called brand marketing and performance marketing. And I hate those terms and I hate talking about this tension, but it is real. I was recently with a group of about 80 CMOs. I polled them on the top issue they're wrestling with, and most of them chose this issue. So you've wrestled with this in all of your roles. So I'd like you to talk about, how do you think about this issue? Is it something you think about intentionally? What do you think is missing in our industry that makes it such a difficult choice to allocate your dollars toward performance versus brand? So I'd love you to talk a little bit about your approach to this tension, if you will.
Yeah, so I've got an acronym that is burned in my brain. You may have heard it before, maybe
I have.
Not.
I think I know where you're going on this.
Sales overnight, brand over time. Yep. SANBOT is what we call it. You know, I think as a CMO, you're responsible for both.
And that comes from Yum Brands. It's a very famous slogan within philosophy within Yum Brands.
Yeah. So we've got to build sales overnight and brand over time. We talk about it at Carter's of what is the right way to turn the dial between emotion and promotion. And when I walked in the door here almost 3 years ago at Carter's, I would say we were heavily weighted towards promotion. Coupons. You know, I always say we were the Bed Bath & Beyond of baby. You would not walk in without one of those blue 20% off coupons to Carter's. And I think that's something that, you know, we sort of said we need to dial up the emotion of the attachment. People don't buy baby clothes because they're 20% off. They buy them because they remember the emotion of the moment of holding a child and bringing them home from a hospital and what outfit they were in. And so, you know, as a leader in marketing, you are responsible for driving the daily sales, and you are responsible for building the brand over time. What I found is, you know, there's never one 50-50 or 60-40 split. It's a flow, and you have to figure out during what times how do you turn the dial to do which. But what I have found is if you invest in brand over time, it will repay off in sales overnight in the future. And so, you know, that's one of the things that we've spent a lot of time over the last 3 years at Carter's doing is building that brand. Whether it be partnering with like Hillary Duff and having a chief mom officer, whether it be doing a fun little social thing where we're doing sort of blowout insurance and giving parents a coupon for a free bodysuit in case their kid has a blowout in a bodysuit, and really, you know, attaching to that emotion.
If they're wearing Pampers, they won't have a blowout. You know that.
Oh, and there's always a P&G man at heart. And so for those moments, you know, what I found is if you can get the emotional hooks into a customer, that will pay off way more. But at the same time, during times are tough, you've got to turn up the promotional dial. And so it's about a flow. But if you're not doing both, you're doing it wrong, is my sense. I can't tell you, in every business I've been is slightly different about where you sit on the dial. But if you are not investing in brand, ultimately the brand will erode over time.
And as you think about people that you are get promoted within Carter's and move ahead in your performance reviews and talent sessions, is it someone who has moved the brand and the sales? You look at both of those?
Yeah, I would say there's three components of how I think about growing leaders is yes, can you build a brand? Can you drive sales? But the number three one, which is actually number one for me, which is, are you building a team of the next generation of leaders?
Mm-hmm. By the way, at P&G, that's what the criteria was to move ahead. Building a team, building a brand, building a business. You have to do all three to be promoted. So, second issue I want to talk to you about is how to manage brands like Carter's and Oshkosh B'gosh and your exclusive brands for retail partners like Walmart, Target, Amazon. That's not easy. And it kind of is easy to say, right? You have your own brands and you have exclusive brands. But how do you work that? How do you ensure there's a strategy for growth for your retailers and their brands as well as your brands.
Yeah, it is probably the thing that was one of the most appealing things about taking this job was, you know, we own a very successful direct-to-consumer business with over 700 stores in the United States and a robust and thriving e-commerce business. But we also, as you mentioned, have exclusive brands at Target, at Walmart, at Amazon, and then, you know, at the and our master brand Carter's and Oshkosh at Kohl's and Macy's, and you name it. And it is a fine balancing act. The great news is we have brand differentiation with each of those exclusive brands. So we have something unique to offer our partners that allows them to have service a slightly different customer in a different way, while also remaining true to the core essence of the master brand. And so I think that's been one of the biggest learning facets for me of this job has been around managing those retailers who are evolving massively. As you know, it used to be you're working with the Target and the Walmarts and you're working them directly. Now there's the in-house media agencies and retail agencies inside those with the Roundels and the Walmart Connects. And they are great partners to us. And we have slightly different relationships with all of them, but they've all been very positive, and we find ways to, you know, make each brand sing in a unique way for their customer set that I think is very powerful for each of those individual wonderful retailers.
You know, it must be a great strength though, to be able to tap into consumer insights with all those retailers, with your team, with your brands, with your stores. That I would think is an enormous competitive advantage based on that business model.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at what's going on in the marketplace, we are sold almost in every outlet you can find across the United States, every channel, every retailer. And so we get to synthesize a lot of knowledge across those retailers and understand what makes mom tick and what is she thinking about today. And so I think that is a superpower of this company for the last 20 years. It's nothing bespoke to me, but it's just something that's been a superpower. And I think it's a good play to have a portfolio. You know, if your wholesale partners and your exclusive brand partners are doing well and your retail's not, it can shift, or sometimes it shifts the other way. It's a nice balancing act. And ultimately a rising tide raises all ships.
What has been the magic behind Carter's and Oshkosh B'gosh? I mean, they're venerable brands. I'm sure they have wonderful brand equities. I haven't seen the data, but I'm sure they do. They've stood the test of time. They've evolved. What has been the magic of those two brands?
Wow. That's a good question. I think they're slightly different, right? I think for the Oshkosh B'gosh brand, it is a brand that we are constantly making sure that it is relevant, because it is a brand so rich and so steeped in nostalgia. When I took the job as the CMO at Carter's here, the number one thing I got sent was pictures of my friends wearing Oshkosh B'gosh as a kid. It is an iconic burned in memory that everyone has, whether it is, you know, JFK Jr. crawling underneath his dad's desk in Oshkosh overalls, whether it's Prince Harry as a child with Diana in Oshkosh overalls, everyone has that memory. And it is, when you talk to parents and when we do qualitative research, it is the brand that parents tend to pack away one piece of clothing to keep and pass it down to the grandchild of the Oshkosh they had as a kid, because those overalls are so iconic. It has an unbelievable brand equity across lots of different design elements that you may not think of, but as soon as you see them, you go, okay, that's Oshkosh. And so we've tapped into it in a rebrand and an updating our branding last year, and a campaign we launched last year, just leaned into all that rich, iconic, but updated and really that sort of nostalgia. And I think that's a secret sauce. But the question is how do you remain relevant to the next generation? How do you keep it alive and not rest on what used to be? So that's, I think, where Oshkosh is. Carter's, I think, has just become so ubiquitous with baby, and it is passed down and it is trusted, much like a Pampers, that it is so trusted. You know, when you think about, when we look at all of our brand equity scores around trust and what it means to be a parent and understanding that, and a brand I would recommend, Carter's has been there and it occupied such an amazing space that in times where the world gets tough, you go to the brands you love and the brands you trust. And that brand has been steeped in trust for 160 years. And the power, particularly when you become a parent, the first thing you ask generally is, mom, dad, what do I do? And so when that is a powerful tool to tap into. And now that's changing a little bit. You still ask mom and dad, but now you watch TikTok and you watch all the other places, Instagram. So that's the challenge that we face today, is how to make sure our brands are there in the next sphere of influence going forward.
I want to move to the creator brief. And the first one is that you have a side hustle, right? And you're an investor and a mentor for a consumer products accelerator, which helps to get young companies off the ground through a 15-week program. So I'd like to ask you, why do you do that? And what have you learned from that to help you be a better CMO?
Yeah, I think it's about, I'm constantly curious. I love to mentor both companies as well as people because I think I learn a lot more than I'm able to give back, quite frankly. I love giving back. I've had an unbelievable list of mentors across my career that have been very generous with their time and their knowledge. And I feel like if I can pass that down, that's something that I can do. But somewhat selfishly, I learn. I see what's out in the marketplace. I can honestly say I don't necessarily have that entrepreneurial gene in my body. It takes someone who is wired just different than everyone else to be a true entrepreneur. And so it's not a gene that I necessarily had. So watching that up close, understanding what it means, learning what it means to be reminded to be able to market without money. Because a lot of these startup brands, they don't have the budgets that I've had throughout my career. What channels are they thinking about? How are they looking through it? What are they thinking about from a performance and a brand perspective? If you look at the brands that I think these digitally native brands that are growing, they are doing unbelievable things and they're building brand first. That's what's been really exciting. You know, I've been lucky to be close and see a couple of the brands up close through the accelerator, through friends that build other brands. And you look at a brand that, I introduced to Whole Foods. They're having some problems and I knew Whole Foods an end. So I helped make an introduction for them. Liquid Death, spring water. Right. I have not advised them at all other than helping them, introducing them to someone at Whole Foods that I knew to get in a big way. But what they've done from building that brand to going against the grain to, tapping into multiple brilliant insights, they have built a community, an army of followers without really spending a lot of money at the outset on traditional performance marketing. And so when you see some of these tactics, you think, how can I apply them to a 160-year-old brand? How do I bring that insight to life inside the confines of corporate America? And so that's probably why I lean in and try and continue to message and learn. The last wave, I've been advising a company actually out of Ohio, out of Cleveland, a startup brand that does applesauce. And he's a young entrepreneur. He's been doing this since he was 15. It's his grandfather's recipe. It's called Holmes Mouthwatering Applesauce. I'll give him a plug here. He's just a wonderful human being. And he's sort of innovating in a space that if you've been in the applesauce shelf, it's pretty standard. And he's doing some interesting things in the space.
What have you found that trips up most young companies that you've worked with through the accelerator?
I think a lot of people have brilliant ideas, but it all comes down to the ability to execute and operate. It is an incredibly complex environment, particularly the ones I do. I do a lot of CPG accelerator work. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot around the execution and knowing that you need to edit in order to amplify. And a lot of these brands, they want to be all things to all people out of the gate. And what you find is the brands that do it really well, edit to amplify. How do you become one thing and know who you are so that everyone can understand who you are? Instead of wanting to be, a brand that does 14 product lines out of the gate. That's one of the things I think Liquid Death did so well. They did one great skew and did it better than anyone else in the category and broke through. And I think that's where you see a lot of brands fail is they try and do too much and that adds operational complexity. It adds brand understanding complexity for the consumer. The consumer gets confused. And if I think about it that way, it's that they don't edit to amplify.
What did you learn about marketing at NASA?
I mean, I always felt out of my depth at NASA. I always say I was the dumbest person to ever work at NASA. There's incredibly brilliant people there. What I learned was about curiosity. These individuals, these scientists spend their life searching for something that hasn't yet to be proven. They're out there scouring the universe for signals of stars, of radio signals, trying to find the signal within the noise. And for me, the ability to find the signal within the noise is what's always made me curious. And my signal within the noise I'm looking at is the consumer landscape, and I'm searching for that signal. But they're out there looking truly at the noise of the universe and trying to find that signal for whether it be extraterrestrial life or whether it be a new element out there in the vastness of space. So really for me, it's really been about trying to find the signal within the noise.
I love it. Very, very zen in a way, right?
Somewhat. I don't know about that.
And this might be in a coincidence, but my wife and I were in the UK for about 10 days recently, and I saw a lot of t-shirts of NASA. So I don't know if you're the people who have followed you are doing a great job in licensing, but I saw an awful lot of apparel with their brand on it.
I think it is probably, one of the best brands in the world. It's got an iconic logo that everyone knows, the sort of the meatball logo.
Yeah.
It's, and then even if you think about the 70s, there was recently, they revived the design book of the original script of that red NASA script. I can't remember the designer that did it, but it was absolutely another brilliant turn. But I think everyone loves, the insight, of what NASA's mission is. And sort of that true value statement of for all mankind. That's something everyone can get behind. And so I think there is this notion of just a cool factor to NASA, but also a yearning for everyone to be part of something bigger than themselves.
What brand is making an impact on you today? Not counting one of your brands.
Not counting one of my brands. I would say that the brands that are making an impact on me, I don't have a lot of time. I'm a CMO, but first and foremost, I'm a husband and a father. And as I think we were talking about, maybe before we started this, is I'm coaching Little League baseball every afternoon and all weekends I spend. So I don't have a lot of time. But what I've sort of come into over the last few years is the one place I get pleasure out of is shoes. And so my wife being ex-Nike, I have a very unbelievable, spot in my heart for Air Jordan. What that brand is doing, brand Jordan has done. And so I'm a shoe collector. That's probably my one vice is collecting shoes. And so, whether it be Nike or Adidas and what Adidas and Yeezy have done together, some of these collaborations that are happening, those are what's capturing the spare moments of time that I do have. I promised my wife I won't spend any money on shoes. So I buy shoes and sell and trade. It's a total hobby. I'll buy a pair, it'll go up in value. I'll sell those and use the profits to buy a pair for myself. So it is one of those things, but they've created an entire culture around obsession around that sneakerhead culture. So that's probably, Air Jordan, I think brand Jordan, has done it better than anyone else. And then a plethora of smaller brands. I'm intrigued by, some of these brands that are unbelievable at targeting me. There's a hat brand called Melon, which is, a sort of high-end baseball cap with some, definite elements of performance, but also probably some really great marketing. And then lastly, another D2C brand would be Tecovas, the boot brand out of Austin. I was at Whole Foods and was there when they were sort of roaring into life. And so this sort of direct consumer, and I became a lover of cowboy boots just as much as Jordan's, and you'll catch me in cowboy boots. So I think those brands are doing some interesting things in terms of building, especially Tecovas, knowing they need in-person retail and that retail theater as much as they need a great sort of e-commerce business.
You're a great blend of creative and analytical. How do you keep both sides of your personality sharp?
I would say I simply get really good people around me, right? So if I were to look back and say strengths finder, my strengths is probably on the creative side. My weaker side is the performance side. I was really good at math, but it wasn't something from an analytics that came naturally. And it wasn't something in the QSR that was really heavily weighted in QSR. It was only once I got into grocery and looked at the analytics of shelf placement and all the things and IRI data and all those things that you look at as a traditional CPG manager and coming up. And so I would say I've really put an emphasis on finding other great creative minds that challenge me. I've got one of those on my team today that challenges me creatively and pushes our agency partners and pushes me to think. And similarly, finding great analytics leaders to help strengthen a skill that I am not that sharp at. So I really, it comes down to people more than, my ability to study. It's really around sort of getting those people that sort of iron sharpens iron and getting people that will challenge you and push you further along than you could ever be just by reading in a book or trying to learn on your own.
You've been a pretty good leader over time in bringing popular culture into your brands, into their messaging, into their story, into their marketing, into their narrative, and you continue that today. What's been your lesson on doing that effectively?
We are in the, I don't know who coined the phrase, whether it was Gary Vaynerchuk or one of those, right? We're in the the attention economy, right? And, you know, what one of the buzzwords or phrases we use internally is we have to produce content at the speed of culture. And we have to capture the public's imagination and we have to be relevant today. And so that for me, and it was something I learned probably at Taco Bell's where we is really where I got a sort of boot camp and master's in marketing at the speed of culture, was how do we turn those moments of culture into marketable moments? You know, at Taco Bell, we basically were launching the first ever mobile ordering app. It didn't exist. This is pre-Uber Eats, pre-DoorDash back in 2010. And we sort of thought, how are we going to get people to talk about Taco Bell? How are we going to talk about ordering through an app? It's not. And so, you know, what we ended up doing was we called it the Taco Bell blackout, and we blacked out every social media account and like erased all of our followers and, you know, basically said, we're going to turn off the machine of marketing and hope someone notices. And it was probably the most unnerving 3 hours of my life sitting there watching a clock tick going, is anyone going to notice that our Twitter followers went from several million to zero, that our profile icons across everywhere is black? Because that's how people were starting to communicate in 2010, 2011, 2012. And then that first tweet that comes out, I was like, what happened to Taco Bell's followers? And then you watch the snowball and suddenly we're on TMZ and they're asking, you know, actors in the street, do you know where Taco Bell is? And suddenly we're in culture in a way that we could never have done with a great media buy or with a great marketing campaign. And so whether that be, you know, it's at Carl's Jr., we did a 420 burger where we infused barbecue sauce with CBD. And that was a buzz that was going on across the cultural landscape. And suddenly we had a line wrapped around the block and we're serving more burgers in the first hour than we thought we'd serve all day. And it made national press. And it was only in one location. So I think it is, and now we're doing the same thing, you know, with Carter's. And how do you find those moments of infusing culture into the brand? And so that's something that I think great brands, it used to be a nice to have, it's a must have now. Mm-hmm. If you're not in culture, you will be irrelevant, and a brand must remain relevant at all times.
Who's been the most inspiring person in your life?
My dad, bar none. My dad. I would not be the human I am today, the leader I am today, the father I am today. He had nothing to do with marketing. He's a numbers person on the business side, but he is probably one of the greatest leaders I've got a chance to work around. He worked in universities across his career. You know, but he stood up, you know, and was really made a point of advancing diversity and inclusion throughout his career in the university environment. That's, you know, had a big impression on me. And he taught me, you know, about always doing the right thing. And if you do the right thing, it will pay off in spades. And really, you know, he mentored tons of people that I'm still friends with today, that, you know, almost building the mentor network for me that when I grew up, and those people that he mentored now have played a role in my life. You know, he has been sort of the stalwart and sort of, if you will, the measuring stick by my success. And so while, you know, I would like to think I've done a good job living up to that, you know, he's got a 30 plus year head start and I've got a lot of ways to go to catch up to him.
What's his best advice been to you?
Be yourself, be true. You know, I think he has been the person who said that, you know, even from a small child, I'm marched to be my own drummer. I'm a little bit, you know, a little bit eccentric at times and a little bit goofy. And, look, I'm wearing a giant Hawaiian shirt. Yeah. You know, at Yum Brands, and throughout my career, I've worn crazy colored pants. I'm more comfortable in jeans, with post COVID, but I used to wear bright pink, yellow, green pants. That's me. And, you know, he told me when I remember in eighth grade, I was trying to figure out, you know, what was next and going to high school and all this. And he said, just be yourself. Be you, and that's the best version of you can be. And so I've remained true to being who I am, and always doing the right thing. And, you know, always doing the right thing has gotten me to a good place. And so, you know, I'm just thankful every day that I got to be born to that man.
That's a good place to stop, but we're going to have one more question. You were my student, so I would be remiss if we ended this podcast without giving you a chance to ask a question to your previous professor in a different time in our lives.
I know it's been 10 or 12 plus years since I was in your class. You know, I would love to ask the question of you, you know, knowing your history of what I think of as some of the more iconic brand turns with Pampers over your career and focusing on wellness. When do you know you're onto the right mission and values? That's always the thing I feel like I'm always wrestling with is, is how do you find, you know, we're always looking for that insight, that understanding. What is it that you hear or see or feel that makes you think I'm on the right path?
This is going to sound really simple, but I think when you can explain that path to people across your company outside of marketing, and they're excited by it, they understand it, they want to get on board with it, they want to bring it to life, they want to be part of it. So to me, when there is a level of buzz and excitement across functions, disciplines, regions, whatever it might be about that, you know you're onto something. You know, one practice, I did this when I was a young brand manager. Every time we had a new ad, and my brand at that time was Jif Peanut Butter. It was a pretty big brand for P&G back then. Every new ad, and this was, you know, the days of most of the budget being in TV advertising, every new ad I would take to our factory. And I'd ask the plant manager if I could stay for a 24-hour period and show every shift the advertising and ask them, what do they think? Is this us? And do they have any ideas to make it better, to make the next one better, to make this one better? And that was so good on so many levels. I learned, they felt part of something. It brought down some traditional silos back then. And if I had an ad that did not resonate with them, it was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't go forward with it. Yeah. So anyway, I think that's the best way to tell if you're onto something.
Oh, that's very simple. And I think couldn't be more true. So I'm going to take that one and write it down right now.
Jif, give my best to your wife, to your dad. I know you have a baseball game tonight you're coaching. All the best with that. Nothing like baseball games with 9-year-olds and 11-year-olds.
Right? Oh, nothing quite like it. And especially when it's in 95-degree weather. So got to keep the kids cool and healthy.
Keep that Hawaiian shirt on.
Yes, definitely. Well, it was great to talk to you. Thanks for having me. And it was a pleasure to see you after 10 years post
too long.
Professorship.
Too long. Let's meet at a Carter sometime. I'll be there buying some baby clothes, right?
Yep, there we go. I like it.
All right, Jif, thanks again.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Jif Jenkins. 3 takeaways from this one for your brand, business, and life. The first one, the importance of having a brand framework to guide the actions on your team in bringing your brand to life. Great companies have explicit frameworks that align everyone to the brand's purpose and how it will go to market. Jif talked beautifully about the importance of that concept, which he learned back at UCLA Anderson when I was a professor. He talked about how he has brought that to life in his career. The second takeaway, we should all be more chief than marketer. He talked about being 90% chief, 10% marketer. And the most important adjustment a leader makes as they get more senior is they become more of a chief. He said the hardest lesson he learned was learning how to let go. Third takeaway, how important it is to have a coach who loves you, who is honest with you, who cares for you. He talked about his wife and his father as tremendous life coaches and business coaches. It was very sweet, and I think it's an important concept for all of us to think about. No one cares more about us than our family. That's it for this episode of the CMO Podcast. If you found this helpful and entertaining, I would be so grateful if you could share our show with your friends. And I would be super happy if you subscribed so you can be updated as we publish new episodes. And if you really want to help, leave us a 5-star rating and a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The CMO Podcast is a Gallery Media Group original production.